Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Let me now formally welcome you. So I'm Mike Kalichman. I'm director for the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology. This program is the sixth in a series of programs that we're calling the Henrietta Lacks Series. The Ethics Center has been running programs like this one at the Fleet Science Center since May of 2008. And you will be among the first people to know that we are looking forward to our 50th program here at the end of the series, the May program that's coming up. Tonight's program is one of many that are focusing on the Henrietta Lacks book with the goal of trying to look at issues in ethical challenges for science and technology related to the story of Henrietta Lacks. What we hope to do with this program, as with all of our programs, is have you engage with others, not just hear from scientists and academics, but engage with others that are in the audience and with the academics about where the ethical challenges are and seeking the solutions to those challenges. We ask our audience, especially those of you who are new, to think of this as an opportunity to hear from others who might think differently from you. And those of you who are new have not heard me say before that just because somebody disagrees with you does not always mean that they are both ignorant and evil, while it sometimes may. So for tonight's program, Catherine Kantarjeff, a dean from California State University San Marcos, is our speaker. Catherine is relatively new to San Diego, but generously agreed to represent CSU San Marcos in our series. Catherine is a scientist first, and she has an excellent perspective on an important part of the story of Henrietta Lacks that I'm going to allow her to tell you about now. So I want to welcome Catherine to the podium.
So I want to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk to you this evening about the Henrietta Lacks story and the parallels that I found as a scientist with the story in my area of science. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that area in a minute. I also see some areas of parallelism because in the information age where we practice science, technology drives our science. Data are much more readily accessible. Data are being generated at a very rapid pace. And in the same way that we saw ethical issues and dilemmas emerge as developments perhaps surpassed or got ahead of regulations and guidelines, we are seeing that as well in certain areas of science, including my own, which now I'll tell you is X-ray diffraction and protein crystallography. So what I'm going to tell you about, to put it in the proper context, is describe for you the evolution of technology and to explain two terms that drive science today. One is the concept of cyber infrastructure, which was a word coined by the National Science Foundation. And related to that, cyber-enabled research, which means remote enabling of instruments and processes, of which I've been very actively engaged for the last 15 years. Associated with that comes not only the technology, but a change in pedagogy when we train future scientists, and also paradigm shifts in the way we conduct our science. And I'm going to just mention briefly the drivers, the opportunities, and the risks associated with that, which in many ways parallel elements of the book about the Henrietta Lacks story. I then will, sadly, as also I'm an editor on the editorial board of a journal, share with you some stories from the trenches that we're not very proud of in the field of crystallography, but they demonstrate that in the information age, it's not business as usual anymore. And in crystallography in particular, we have seen some interesting cases of gross misuse of technology, lack of skill, and in some cases, deliberate fraud. And along with that comes the whole issue of where the web is going and how we communicate today. And a lot of that is driven by social media. And social media can be used as a very powerful resource. It can also do some harm. And it affects teaching and learning, how we creatively express ourselves, how we perform as professionals in our disciplines. And it also will lead to new kinds of pedagogy and paradigms and something we call the knowledge economy. Information, the way it's exchanged today, has a value that differs depending on how that information is accessed and utilized. And then I aim at the end to leave you with some talking points to lead into the Q&A. So cyber infrastructure, as I said, is a phrase coined by the National Science Foundation, and what it means is that it's the aggregate of software, hardware, and other technologies, as well as the expertise needed to drive and support current and future discoveries. And many of the elements of cyber infrastructure that you see on this slide are the things that we utilize in science every day: data management and analysis, automation in the laboratory, remotely enabled instruments, remote control of instruments, collaboration over the web. And in my field, where we determine and analyze structures of molecules, we use visualization and modeling quite frequently. This has implications for learning and workforce development, because future scientists need to be nimble and skilled with these kinds of technologies in the information age. And they need to be able to utilize them, adopt them, and apply them for their own kinds of research. And this impacts those of us in academia as to how we teach and prepare those, that future generation of scientists. And so we like to use these technologies as much as possible to help them gain practical experience and be able to conduct research, but also to use the tools skillfully and appropriately and ethically. Cyber-enabled research, which is a variation of this, is something that I've been very much involved with over the last 15 years. It just means that we now use the very high bandwidth connections of the internet to connect us to supercomputing clusters, expensive instruments such as electron microscopes. My X-ray diffractometers in this California State University are accessible to all of the faculty and students throughout the system, and we even have a nationwide consortium that can access those instruments. Particle accelerators, synchrotrons such as the synchrotron at Stanford. And we utilize these connections not only to acquire data, but we also now utilize these connections to work with distant colleagues, to leverage expertise, to collaborate. And we can also use it to train people. This whole idea of groups of people coming together to work with a common goal and a common theme and a common interest was something that was described in the late 90s by Howard Rheingold in a book called The Virtual Community, Homesteading on the Electronic Frontier. And what he describes more than 10 years ago is very accurate to where we are today. People come together unified in a virtual space for a common purpose. And it isn't just about posting words on a page, the static web pages of Web 1. It's about interaction and collaboration and integration on the web. It is a true community. So the drivers for doing or engaging in cyber-enabled research and utilizing cyber infrastructure are mainly three. One at the bottom of the slide is actually probably very important today. It's economics. The basic tools to do cutting-edge research today are becoming prohibitively expensive. In my field of research, where I need very high-intensity X-rays, I can't have a synchrotron across the street. I have to be able to utilize that resource in an effective way. So expense is one. Money is one. Another one is that information technology has made tremendous progress in the last decade, and the costs have come down. And it makes it very easy now for us in science and more affordable to share data, tools, computing power, and expertise by collaborating across the web. Data storage is cheap, networking is cheap, and computational capability and capacity has expanded tremendously. And of course, we all know, particularly those who are scientists now or former, that a growing number of science and engineering fields are becoming extremely information and computation intensive. So a few examples are on the slide: genomics, earth science, clustered computing, and of course, our distributed systems of advanced instruments throughout the world. And of course, everything now is highly mobile. I read my book on my iPad, okay? So we're in the cloud with our data, we're mobile, I can control my instruments from my iPod. Everything is readily accessible on demand. And that changes the way we communicate, and it changes how we access and utilize scientific information. So in 2008, because of my activities and involvement with the remotely enabled instruments, the National Science Foundation and its Office of Cyber Infrastructure were interested in developing white papers and concept papers, policy documents, about best practices for utilizing these kinds of tools in chemistry and also more broadly in the sciences. And so our group, our nationwide e-consortium of instruments, mostly undergraduate institutions, I might add, ran a workshop, and the outcome of that was a white paper that's shown on the slide, and you can find it on the web at the NSF. And the questions we were asked to address were, how can we use advancing cyber infrastructure capability as productively as possible? How can we maximize the use and the throughput? But more importantly, how do we create institutional and policy frameworks that facilitate research collaboration using these new tools? Because those kinds of frameworks didn't exist, and to a large extent, they still don't. And where do we need to be going with regard to connecting remote instruments and using cyber infrastructure, and how do we maximize and prioritize these for impact in the broader community at large? So the state of affairs in science today is that we have extremely powerful tools that are accessible to us. This happens to be a synchrotron storage ring in its early stages that's in Campinas in the state of São Paulo in Brazil. It's a national light source for all of South America, but many of the instruments are remotely enabled, and scientists all over the world can utilize the equipment and the instruments. Layer this with the fact that we are incredibly well connected. Data transfers extremely rapidly. We can collaborate, corroborate, validate, access, analyze, or misinform. There are tremendous questions that are still of interest to people about molecules, in my case. Fundamental ones, but more exotic questions. There is also because of technology, the ability now and the accessibility of scientists who are not specialists in a particular field to access and utilize tools and instruments that are not their primary area of expertise. And in the broadest sense, we affectionately call them the naive users. That doesn't mean they can't do it, but they need help. And those of us who are experts need to utilize these tools to help them use them with skill, ethically, and appropriately. Now you layer on top of this what we affectionately call an academia publisher parish. There's tremendous pressure to have that grand experiment make a big splash on the cover of a journal. You want the large grant. Competing for grant dollars is becoming extremely competitive. There's people with lots of good ideas and not enough money to go around. And this puts tremendous pressure. And with the ease of the use of technology, there's some temptation to do some not so nice things. So we face some interesting dilemmas in editorial offices. We read interesting things, and I'm using interesting in quotes, in the scientific literature. And in the last few years in my field of research, we've seen some very high-profile and embarrassing retractions, either due to lack of skill, premature publication, or outright fraud. So because I'm a crystallographer and I'm speaking to an audience where I don't think there may be any crystallographers, but if you are, raise your hand. Okay. There you are. Okay. I always use this quote because it really explains who we are and what we do. This is a quote from the first edition of Acta Crystallographica, the primary journal of the International Union of Crystallography. Our science borders naturally on many other sciences, but our distinction is that we are interested in the methods and results of investigating the arrangement of atoms in matter, as particularly when it has interesting features. Our goal is to elucidate the structure of molecules at or near the atomic resolution of detail and utilize that structural information in a predictive framework. We'd like to understand why molecules work the way they do, and in my particular area of research, which is structure-guided drug design, we would like to utilize that structural information to design new therapeutics. Now, if you don't do that well, there's a whole domino effect of the impact of bad structural data. Because our databases, as you'll see in a minute, are public databases, and 80% of the scientists who utilize those databases are not crystallographers like I am. And the onus is on us in the field to make sure that they understand the integrity and the nature of the data which they're mining to display pictures of molecules and design experiments. So in my science, light, in this case X-rays, is the messenger. Our data are the scattering patterns from crystals of the molecules in which we're interested. The intensities of that scattering is digitized, but the information contained in that scattering pattern the X-rays are exquisitely sensitive to the underlying structure of the molecules in the crystal. So from the X-rays, we ultimately will generate various representations of molecular structure. To me, a molecule isn't the ball and stick diagram you often see in a textbook. It looks more like that chicken wire, which is the electron density map. It's a map of the topological space of the molecule. And we model that in various ways to illustrate the chemical and physical properties. What is typically in a structural database that a scientist who's not a crystallographer will use, such as a biochemist or a biologist, will be the coordinates that will enable molecular graphic systems to make these pretty pictures. But the point here is that the data are not the nice ribbon drawing or the ball and stick in the lattice packing of the crystal. The data are really what are on the left of this slide, the scattering pattern, the raw images of the diffraction pattern. And in the current state of affairs, those are never archived and they're never made accessible to the users in the database. It's the coordinates. And we have to somehow get from the left side to the right side, and that is where the skill comes in. That is where crystallography drives technology, and that is where technology drives crystallography. And if you don't know what you're doing in that middle step, very bad things can happen. And it is not fair to the scientific community when those kinds of bad data, like contaminated cells, are circulating for a while. It takes a long time to get it back out of the system. So in the early part of the last decade, I served for 12 years on the United States National Committee for Crystallography and chaired it for 6. And we conducted surveys of the community to find out what was necessary to improve things in crystallography because we saw what was coming down the pipe with the developments in technology. And it was clear that perhaps due to all of these advances, which now enable people to engage in our science, it also involves engaging people with not enough background to effectively use the technology and understand the data in the databases to drive their experiments, to make grant proposals, or to even understand the scientific literature to determine whether what they're reading is valid or not. So the parallels that I see to the Henrietta Lacks story are that popular media puts a lot of pressure on people. If you're going to get funded, you want to do hot science. Sexy science sells. It's reality. And when it goes viral in the social media, if you are on Facebook or Twitter, you know when some new hot science story appears, it's out there real quick. Try to rein it back in if it's wrong. It takes a while. I also see a parallel often now because of pressure that people want to share hot data, a hot tip. You can crystallize this protein this way. They will release property for general scientific use before publication or publish prematurely. It's very easy to do that now with the collaborative web. A quick email, package arrives. Okay? You can text somebody. It's very easy to share misinformation as well. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, there are tremendous pressures to publish, get funded. There are gains to be had if you publish quickly. Maybe you want to be famous. So I use benevolent deception here in a loose way, but I think wishful thinking is kind of a form of benevolent deception. Okay? You really want to see a result. You're willing to kind of ignore what doesn't look right. That happens in crystallography, as you'll see in a minute. And the extreme of that is bending the truth. So, now here's some of the dirty laundry from the editorial office. In 2006, 5 papers reporting protein structures of great significance to the medical community were retracted. To the credit of the authors, they were retracted. They were incorrect because they were all based on a faulty model due to an error in software that nobody had picked up. Premature publication? I don't know. But to the credit of the authors, they were retracted. However, those data in the publications were out there for several months. People based experiments on them. People talked about them. They were presented at conferences. Chris Miller, who's a Howard Hughes Medical Institute fellow, in 2007 wrote an op-ed piece, an editorial about this incident, and he made a very astute observation, which is a take-home lesson to all scientists, and that is, lovely colored ribbons festooning the covers and pages of journals are just models. They're not the data. Very true. And it may look good, but if it doesn't explain the chemistry, if it doesn't explain the function, if there's an inconsistency, you can't ignore that. And wishful thinking can lead you to do that. There were things about the HeLa cells that didn't look right to some people, but they were willing to ignore those details and move forward. There's a danger to that. In the extreme, I will tell you about two incidences of improper science, because with information being digitized, it's very easy to manipulate. And if you know how to do that effectively with mathematics, it's very difficult to detect, but digital forensics is a growing field. 13 protein structures that had been determined, quote-unquote, experimentally, between 1999 and 2006 have actually now been removed from our database, the protein data bank at Rutgers. The retracted structures were deliberately fabricated because there is no evidence that the experimental data were ever collected, and the signatures of the data that we know from physical properties were not real. But it took 10 years just to even find them, and another 5 to get them out of the database. It took even longer to get the papers out of circulation. This is now subject to investigation at the Office of Research Integrity because the investigator had about $5 million in grants from the NIH, National Institutes of Health, and that has to be paid back somehow. That's taxpayers' money, and he will probably go to jail. So, what's the good part of this? Better guidelines, more strict validation of X-ray models prior to publication and deposition in the database, better validation by peer review. Submission of data. So while we don't deposit the raw images from our experiments because they are really, really large files, the mathematical digitization of that can be deposited, and that is now mandatory by all the granting agencies. I'll just point out at the bottom of this that half the structures that were fraudulent didn't have any of those data, so there was no way of validating them at the time. Small molecule structural chemists are equally guilty in this. During some retooling and improvements to validation software, one of our co-editors at Acta Crystallographica stumbled upon 70 structures that just looked odd. And indeed, what made them really odd was not only statistics, but the chemistry didn't make sense. In other words, bend the truth, wishful thinking, ignore the fact that the chemistry doesn't look right. There were unexplained features fundamental to chemistry, odd bond lengths, odd vibrational parameters. And it turns out that what the authors had ultimately done was taken an existing structure and decided to change one atom in the middle, but never recalculated the data that would be consistent with that model. So this is the really insidious thing, is that more than one structure had been determined and deposited, and they were all based on identical data sets that had been deposited. It took a while and some detective work to sort that out. And what really irks me as an editor and a scientist is that the papers that reported these 70 structures really don't describe anything that's real. And people read these and based synthetic reaction schemes on them. Oh, excuse me, my social media is coming up. Okay. So now this number's up to 129, and it's still growing because we know what to look for. So people can't get away with this anymore. So better validation software. Availability of data enabled this detection work. The data were not hidden or protected or screened. And the importance of somebody who knows what they're doing. The editor who found all of this was very skilled and very skeptical and very experienced, and he knew what to look for. I will leave you with the bottom of this slide that says, sadly, this is not restricted to my science. There's an article from 2010 in Current Science that relays several interesting stories where technology has helped people do funny things, perhaps. And journal editors are increasingly under pressure to curb adverse attention to their journal and express concern about publications because it gives them bad press. You want high-impact science in a high-impact journal. You want readership. And to have something retracted or express concern in an editorial letter is not desirable. And journals are very reluctant to pull things from publication. So my questions to leave you with first, before I finish the talk with the technology piece, is where does this leave publications that have cited these works I told you about? or have based interpretations or research on them? Where does it leave degrees that were granted based on that work? I don't know that PhDs are retracted. I have not read of one yet. How are the people who work in the labs where these mistakes and frauds were committed involved or impacted? In the case of those 13 structures, all of those data were fabricated, but there were graduate students and postdocs in the lab. How could someone not have known? And if they did, why didn't anything happen? That bothers me. And I'm not an ethicist. That just bothers me as a scientist. What role, then, do we all play, scientists, educators, trainers, mentors, to make sure that this doesn't happen? So the parallels to the HELOS story, wishful thinking. You really want that data. You want that PhD thesis. You're going to ignore that little piece of information. Are you going to bend the truth and, you know, well, yeah, that spurious data point's out there, but we'll ignore it. Maybe very important. And is it really fair? Guidelines. We have found in my field that as the technology has gotten ahead of us, we're keeping up to try to improve our guidelines so that we can validate data. But we have issues in crystallography with intellectual property because people are working on proprietary structures that may be of interest to a pharmaceutical company. And beyond that, if you're collaborating with people on the web and your information is freely distributed, who owns it? It has to also do with privacy and consent. How do you keep back your data? When do you release it? And what sorts of permissions do you need to give people to use it? The figure on the right just shows you what wishful thinking in my field is like. So you're looking at an electron density map in the binding site of a sweet-tasting protein. And the goal of the project was to engineer new kinds of synthetic sweeteners. Okay, that could be a moneymaker, right? So you see that there's this stick figure drawn in the middle, that it represents a potential compound. But it really doesn't, to a novice it might look okay, but there's some funny knobby pieces sticking out in the mesh, the density that's not accounted for. And fortunately this didn't get published because my colleague, whose graduate student had done this, said, no, I don't buy that, let's fish around a little more. Well, it turns out when we crystallize proteins, they come out of a cocktail that has salts and buffers and other interesting things, and it turns out that what that really was the buffer molecule that the crystal was grown with. So the sweet-tasting protein likes test buffer, if you know what test buffer is. Anyway, but it doesn't taste sweet. I didn't taste it, but I know somebody who did. Was that ethical? I don't know. IRB. So let me finish with social media. Social media is how we communicate today. This is how we exchange information. This is how we form virtual communities. It does a lot of good things. It facilitates collaboration, consultation, and directed expertise. But we don't know how to really control where everything goes. We have this phrase we use called viral, right? So our goal as scientists and in the broader community is to find out how we need to regulate this. And if any of you are on Facebook, you know about the timeline thing that's got everybody up in the air because it's going to open up a lot of privacy issues. So the web as we have it and we have to work with is becoming very powerful. But the guidelines for using it, we may not know what those guidelines are going to be yet. So the PC era was very BG. Do you know what BG is? Before Google. This is very BG, okay? The World Wide Web that we called One was static. That was where you went up, you put a page up, you went and read it. It was read-only. Web 2, which was the last decade, was where we were very connected. It was read-write. Everybody was reading and writing. It gave us an opportunity to start validating because information was being put out on the web and people could respond to it. We're now in the Web 3.0 decade, the semantic web, where information is organized, it is personalized, you can put it in context, you can extract meaning from it, and it's really mobile. So it's a tremendous opportunity to extract information and create new kinds of knowledge. The intelligent web, which we're now starting to utilize, is where everything is on all the time. How many of you have a smartphone in your pocket? It's on all the time, right? It's pulling information all the time. You can control equipment with your smartphone. Implanted chips, mobile devices for mobile healthcare and doing mobile diagnostics. All of this is going to make the line between human and technology become somewhat gray. I don't think the guidelines are all there yet for utilizing this effectively or appropriately. And of course, for teaching purposes, this dynamic context enables us to facilitate all kinds of practical applications and collaboration. So, it's very enabling. But the new pedagogy and paradigms are also going to lead us to some problems. We can collaborate, we can consult, we can distribute our expertise, we can teach, we can provide practical experience, but we can also manipulate those data for other purposes. We're at the center of the information space, and this is affecting how we relate to information. It is affecting how we do our research and how we evaluate the credibility of our research and that of our colleagues. It is affecting the way students interact with educators and educators interact with their students and how we behave as professionals. And knowledge today is constructed, contributed to, and consumed on the web all at the same time. That's the knowledge economy. And it's mobile, it's portable, it's connected, and facilitates collaboration. So in our grandiose vision in crystallography, we have a work group who's talking about how to integrate everything we do in our science, from raw data to publication. And imagine a world where our database, deposition is available, the raw data, original data, are there for anybody to access and utilize. It means that anyone could go in, take knowledge that exists there, consume it, regenerate it, improve upon it, put it back out. Yes, it could create better science because things will improve as the technology improves. And falsification hopefully will become near impossible because we can validate. But at this point, where is the ownership? Who owns the data and the information? It's constantly moving and it's constantly dynamic. And we don't have the guidelines for dealing with that just yet. So the parallels to HeLa, which I'll conclude. HeLa cells opened doors to new areas of research, as you read in the book, and it provided the scientists who had access to them with tools to perform studies they couldn't do before. And that did forever change the world of science. But new problems and ethical dilemmas emerged, from contaminated cell lines to sharing of information without attribution. Technological capabilities have advanced our ability as scientists to communicate. We can be more productive, and we have a better quality of life. But it's happening so fast that our ability to comprehend the full potential and impact may be lagging behind the developments. HeLa cells were freely and widely disseminated. And as I said, as a consequence, the distance between the end user and where they originated from, as we wrote in our op-ed piece with Margaret that I'll acknowledge, grew larger and larger. And that happens in science. People go on the web, they're using Google, which is the answer to life, the universe, and everything. My students, when I say, how do you know that's right? They look at me like deer in headlights. It's on Google, it has to be right. In the case of science, with this rapid spread of information, this may leave scientists responsible for generating that original information and that intellectual property without credit. It may make it difficult for us to validate data, to check resources for accuracy, to see ideas in their original context and obtain information. And as we've seen in a lot of areas, not just science, this results in plagiarism. It results in loss of attribution. And as you've seen in a couple of cases I described this evening, fraud. Many scientific achievements have been enabled by my discipline, crystallographic science. 25 Nobel Prizes are attributed to crystallographic work. And it provides tremendous opportunities for new kinds of research because we interface with so many other scientific disciplines. Similarly, the rapid advancements in technology have enabled research and scientists conducting research all kinds of opportunities to ask questions and perform new kinds of experiments that they couldn't do before. Access to an instrument that you could not afford that was millions of dollars and to enable you to do your science is a very powerful draw. And of course, we know that HeLa cells open the doors to new areas of research, as we read in the book. Scientists didn't have to spend all their time keeping cell lines alive. The endless supply of cells afforded them time to do other things and discover things. Contributions to the development of the polio vaccine. And the basic techniques for cloning and in vitro fertilization come from those first developments. And of course, what you may not know from the book, or you know, is that the enzyme telomerase, which repairs DNA, is present in abundance in HeLa cells, and that enables them to live longer than other cells. And anti-cancer drugs now target that enzyme in clinical trials. And I'll point out that the elucidation of the structure of telomerase using crystallography has given science that insight at near the atomic level of detail. So it's a challenging time. Digital technologies are making it possible to manipulate data and research results to an extent not previously possible, which underscores the need for validation and also to help those who are novices to use these tools appropriately and avoid fraud in the information age. At the time that HeLa cells were discovered and characterized, science was in another kind of state of flux, and that was the beginning of the era of genetic research. And the concept of risk to patients had changed, but the guidelines for looking at working with human subjects hadn't yet completely been codified. We don't have all the guidelines for working with Web 4.0 either. So scientists at the time, like perhaps scientists are today, were confused, indifferent, or very skeptical. So whether intentional or unintentional, all scientific misrepresentations cause us serious damage in the scientific community. It leads us as scientists down wrong paths. We may make a proposal to do an experiment that's invalid. Our publications may be impacted. And also, I think perhaps more importantly, it erodes the base of public trust, which funds science. And we need to work hard as ambassadors to not let that happen. But we have to take a care to strike the right balance between allowing scientists independence but still having a healthy respect for the environment in which we're working. And we need to shift our focus from simply throwing content out there to enabling people to extract meaning from it, and that requires introspection, it requires promoting best practices and leading by example, and it requires empowering future scientists with the skills they need to be productive and ethical in their discipline. And ironically, the technology which has led to some of these problems is the same vehicle that can cultivate that kind of climate. So I leave you with William Gibson, who said, "The future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed." And I would like to just acknowledge Michael, Barbara Priest, and Margaret Hing for their assistance and for inviting me. These are the people who have paid the bills over the years to enable me to interface with technology and do my research. My collaborators with some of our consortia. I'll point out the PRISM Consortium is a network of high schools that are interfaced with all our instruments. And at the bottom, the various committees and commissions who have had it high on their priorities to address the issues and the ethical issues of working with with technology and science in the information age. So,
that was a tour de force in terms of covering the idea of increasing complexity to what we have in science today in the context of Catherine's particular area of interest, which is crystallography, and raises numerous questions. Now, our next phase of this program, especially for those of you who are newer to our discussions, is that this is your chance now to ask questions, but also to raise issues that you think are important. What we want to look at is the ethical challenges inherent here. Where are the challenges? Who is responsible for addressing those challenges? What kinds of things might we do to answer those issues? And those of you who do have questions, we have a microphone on the right side for you, and we'd ask you to line up there. And as you are thinking about whether you want to ask a question, I will just remind you that this is an ethics forum, and there's an ethical obligation for you to participate in this discussion and to help us think through the challenging issues. So I will leave you with that thought as you start to think about your questions, and I will turn to Catherine and actually summarize what I thought I heard and ask her for her response to this, that the options for misinformation are numerous when you have such complex data. And I saw at least four different levels of that I think you gave examples of each. One would be somebody who simply does not understand what they're doing, so insufficient understanding. A second level would be somebody who understands what they're doing, but there may well be errors that they have simply missed, and that isn't necessarily bad. That's part of how science occurs. But the third is, you called it benevolent deception, which is a terminology I hadn't heard before, but I like, or self-deception. And then finally, intentional deception. You had several examples of people who had made stuff up that they'd never even done. Would you consider that a full range of the possible ways that one might worry about
misinformation? I believe you summarized that very well. And that applies across science, not just in
right.
my
and
discipline. That's right.
And I think that's probably one of the things we want to look for here. So if we look at those four, do you have particular worries about some of those over the others? And what would you say is the biggest challenge? What should
well,
we try
my concern
and address tonight and find a solution
has
to?
Been for a number of years, I believe it was the first example, where people really don't understand. And they're not given any guidance by experts in the field or constructive feedback to lead them in the right direction. Or if they're using a new technology for the first time, or let's say a software application, that doesn't have bells and whistles that will say, hey, alert, back up to step D, because you're at step Z and you shouldn't be here. It's very wrong. Go back. That's important. And a lot of what we see as poor science is of that kind of, that has that kind of character. I think the ultimate in disturbing me, however, is the last one where it's deliberate fraud. Because that's not right.
So before we go to the first question, let's go to the deliberate fraud area. What is your sense of the rate of deliberate fraud among scientists?
I really don't know. That's an excellent question. And in my field, we've only hit the tip of the iceberg. And we stumbled upon the one case which I gave you as an example, and it's still mushrooming. And so we're not clear how far that will go. I would guess that perhaps the number of fraudulent cases we found in that instance with the ACTA publications is probably going to double. What's also disturbing about that is that it originates primarily from one place among five common investigators, a virtual community of people sharing data. And that's also disturbing. And another aspect of it also is that one of the drivers in that case is that these individuals come from a part of the world where they are incentivized by temptation to do this because they're paid extra when these things happen, when they publish in very high-impact journals and when they get a lot of citations and they bring in large grants. It's a vicious cycle. And the motivation for doing it, which is what drives most scientists, is to get the answer and to do something of benefit to society, is very much clouded by this other aspect of incentivizing and tempting. So,
and to reassure the audience, because it's something I know something of generally in the biomedical sciences, the rate of research misconduct, serious misconduct, as you've described, that has been discovered is 1 in 100,000 scientists per year. That's better than our Congress, for those of you who are doing the arithmetic. But that doesn't mean we've discovered all of the cases of misconduct. And what's worrisome is how much is hidden that we don't know about. So first question.
Validation. That's such a key ethical principle for everything, science in particular, validation. The flip side of that, and the other part is incentives or incentivization, fame, the grants. I'm trying to, in terms of incentives to do the validation stuff, the only thing I can think about is whistleblowing. But what are the incentives, and how do we make those incentives to encourage more applause, credit for validation besides whistleblowing, or what are those?
So just to be clear, so the whistleblowing would be a disincentive, you know, because it's something that would push you because knowing that whistleblowing is there, that scares you, so you don't want to do something wrong.
Well, you don't want to do something wrong, but the people are incentivized. If I do this whistleblowing, that is a
something. Oh, I see. Okay. So what's the incentive for somebody to be a whistleblower as well as what are the incentives to try and validate?
Correct. How do we do those? And again, policy-wise, again, if you get a PhD based upon fraudulent or, you know, bad science, how do we make that bar at a higher one or pull back those PhDs?
To address the first part about just whistleblowing, and I noted on one of my slides that, and I've encountered this and so have several of my colleagues, that journals and editors are generally resistant to retracting things because it tarnishes the image of the journal. I think because of the frequency with which incidents are now being discovered, ironically by the same tools that were used to commit the errors or the fraud, there seems to be a relaxation of that resistance. People are coming forward. What they usually do is we'll contact someone who's a colleague who's on an editorial board and say, I have concerns about X. The editor will take it upon themselves to investigate that. And I've been watching something evolve, which I can't discuss, but it has essentially proceeded in this regard that a set of investigators, not one, it will be group validated. It will be sent out to independent investigators who have no conflict of interest with what's in question, and they will come back with their result to the editor, and the editor will make the final decision. That's how this is evolving in my field. As to how you deal with, and that was my question, degrees granted based on erroneous retracted data that's now no longer in the database, but someone is still carrying the title. I don't know what that's going to take. I really don't.
Okay, I guess my question would be in terms of the ethics of it, regardless of the fact that our goal is to publish and publish as frequently as possible, the reproducibility of a study should still be the gold standard, as far as I'm concerned, because if you are uncovering a scientific truth, you should be able to replicate it. I think that's why we've had so many issues with some of our studies now, is because the work is sloppy. We may have used some obscure references and studies and really haven't looked at, number one, like as you say, the quality of that bibliography. Okay, we've just put it out there so we could get out front, in front of an issue. But again, I think if you're uncovering a truth or a scientific certainty, someone else should be able to replicate it, and that should be the standard by which all studies are measured, as far as I'm concerned.
You mentioned that in your experience, journals are reluctant to retract papers. And that was new to me. I'm not saying it's not true, but it was new to me. And I should tell you, I teach research ethics classes, and I often push the students hard on the point that if they find that something's wrong with their work, an error, something that's significant, a colleague has fabricated something, I always tell them it's in your interest to make that known before somebody else discovers it so that you don't look bad. You want to be the one who reports that. I feel like I need to give that lecture to the editors at journals that would say that they don't want to do this, but I don't know how widely you've heard this and whether you see any solutions to that, which I would see as a big problem.
It is a big problem, and I've seen it mainly in my field, and I've experienced it, where you're pretty convinced that something's not right, and you've got the evidence to show it, but you really have to go over the top to convince an editor that something needs to be retracted. It's changing. And it's changing because I think the value is more in the quality of what is there and the ability to admit that a mistake was made and having the dignity to retract the paper. That actually adds value to the journal because people know that the editorial board is thinking ethically about what they're publishing in their journal. And it is changing. It tends to revert a little bit when something is a really hot-button controversial topic that you know you're going to get a lot of readers, and sometimes publication would be accelerated, the review process would be accelerated to get things out in the literature more quickly. That's changing, and it's changing because there were too many missteps when those kinds of things happen. It's frustrating to scientists when they know that something's not right and they've proven that it's not right because they've tried to reproduce something and it doesn't reproduce. But it takes multiple demonstrations of that to convince an editor that they need to retract something. And, of course, then they have to deal with the whole issue of discussing it with the authors of the manuscript and you run into issues of, accusations and, are you libel and slander and attacks, and there's other legal issues involved, which I think they don't want to get involved with. But they're slowly changing and moving towards accepting the fact that when people come forward and our editors are being instructed to handle things like that more carefully.
So as an academic librarian, I'm going to suggest that there's a whole other level here, and that's academic publishers. In the print days, I'll call it, rather than the old days, we would get a notice that a journal article was going to be redacted, and we would actually take a stamp in those days, and we would stamp those articles. Well, we don't get that information anymore. We assume, and I think we assume naively, that the journal publishers are taking those articles out of the journals. But a recent journal article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, they recently did a study, and there were some very famous articles that supposedly had been redacted, but they were still showing up in the journals. And I'm going to suggest that that's because you have the scholarly organizations that will try to redact those articles. But academic publishing is a multi-million dollar business, and they're not going back taking those materials out.
That's an interesting observation, but brings up a question whether when a paper is retracted, it should be deleted from the literature, unavailable. And I think my understanding is that many journals would say they should still be there, but clearly labeled as retracted or falsified. What are your thoughts on?
I think if they're there, they're left, but they're labeled as falsified or redacted. Users of the databases will probably find that sufficient. If you're searching for references and you don't actually go to that reference point in the database and see the redaction indicated, and you're still seeing just a citation somewhere as you're searching, there's a danger that you'll still use that reference not realizing that it's been redacted unless it's blatantly labeled as such. The other issue, and we see this in my field, is because our science is intimately tied to a number of databases that accompany the publications. When structures are determined, coordinates are deposited, an ID is given to that file, and you have to have this identifier before your paper will be published, and you have to deposit this information within 4 months of publication, or release it within 4 months of publication if you're funded by the federal government, Public Information Act. There is a lag, and not always the timing is the same, that when a paper is redacted, you will still find the data associated with it in the database lingering there for a while. And we had lengthy discussions with the archivists and the curators of these databases about this issue, and now there is a much more intimate communication between the editorial offices and the journal publishers with these primary databases to ensure that if a coordinate file is deemed invalid, the paper is flagged that this piece of data has been removed from access to the database. It's not permanently removed either. It's put in an obsolete archive so that if people want to go back and see what the wrong structure looked like, they can actually request it.
That seems useful. I mean, that seems good. Did you have a...
I was just going to add to that. I agree that the redacted articles should stay in place, but the reason for the redaction should also be included in there, because if there was an issue with some of the studies that were cited or some of the part of the bibliography, number one, the person who used it is additionally flagged, as well as that particular data that's questionable, so that someone else who stumbles into it in this digital age will know that that data has been falsified or there's some serious problems with it.
That's a good point.
So we have just a couple of minutes left, and I would like to, because I actually am not sure about the vote that I got about the whistleblowing question, but it is something that worries me because I see it in science as well, that people are reluctant to come forward, especially if they are more junior in a research group. So I'm going to throw it out to you, since what we're talking about is the science that is behind the world we live in, that helps determine what drugs we'll use, it helps determine new agents that might be used for purposes ranging from cleaning to almost anything you can imagine. All of these things we're doing, are based on the science, and it costs a lot of money. We want this to be done as well as possible, and it's harmed when there are people that are doing things that are intentionally wrong, or even unintentionally wrong, but are simply being involved in benevolent deception. So what, if anything, do you see that we can do or should do to encourage people to be able to come forward when they see something that's wrong? Anybody have any thoughts? Let's see. We have two options. You could speak from where you are, and I'll repeat, or you could go to the microphone. So why don't we... Do you mind going to the microphones? Thanks.
I'm Jennifer. I think whistleblowing is a little problematic for a lot of people. I think that maybe making funding where science gets funded very, very prominent in search results would make it easier for the general public to have a high degree of suspicion when appropriate. I contacted Google today. They have 10 points on their company philosophy. Point number 10 on the second paragraph says that if you can't find what you're looking for on Google, it's our problem, not yours. And you can hold us to that. They say that, too, on the same page. So I thought that was fun, and I'm struck by especially the points about redaction. Is there something that Google can do, particularly Google Scholar, that would facilitate, you know, I want to say integrity in science? Is there something you could think of that could be modified with that type of search? Thank you.
So this isn't directly answering how to encourage people to whistleblow, but it is answering a question about ways that we might increase the integrity of the literature through what's findable, and that's the Google mechanism. Maybe that would be the last. You have any comment on?
Well, and I would say that that's probably a good suggestion, because most of us who use the databases to search the literature and look at citations and a variety of data that we use as indicators and metrics. Google Scholar is actually faster and stays more up to date with what's out there than, say, the Web of Science and other databases that update about every 6 months. So your suggestion about partnering with the scientific community, partnering with Google to be the first source of indicating such a thing actually might not be a bad idea, because people go to Google before they go to anything else.
Yes. So being cognizant of the time, we've covered a tremendous amount.
I thought there was one more hand here.
Well, there was, okay. But I think we're okay on time. So, and we if anybody has questions, they're welcome to come up afterwards. But we've covered a tremendous amount of ground in actually a relatively short time. And I want to thank Catherine Kantarja for helping us navigate some really tough waters and important questions for this evening.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.